Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond 80Z podcast. Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Thank you very much for listening to this latest episode. If you haven't listened before, then welcome. Every episode we talk about different creatives and characters from the James Bond films. At the moment we're at the letter B. If you go back to the beginning, we start obviously with the letter A and we plan to carry on all the way through to the letter Z. Each week the three of us look into a number of different people behind the James Bond films, research as much as we can, and then we come back and deliver our homework in the form of a podcast. So delivering his homework, unless his dog ate it, of course, first.
Not this time.
Is Mr. Tom Wheatley, and you have someone very interesting to talk about. You have a Bond girl to start us off with.
I do indeed. B is for Bouvier, Pam Bouvier. Now, you'll know Pam Bouvier, played by Carrie Lau as the main Bond girl in License to Kill. In that film, Pam Bouvier is a former army pilot and works as a CIA informer, posing as a courier for drug lord Franz Sanchez. But first, I'll just talk a little bit about Carrie Lau and her kind of background and before starring in the film. She was born in February 1961, so she's 59 now, in Huntington, New York. She's got quite an interesting history, actually, as an actress. Her father was a geologist that travelled all around the world. So she spent most of her childhood living in loads of different places, including Libya, the Netherlands, France, as well as loads of different places in the US, like Houston, Texas, Denver and Colorado. She moved to New York City and she started a modelling career for people like Ralph Lauren and Calvin Klein. And she broke into acting with the film Dangerously Close, followed by a role in a Robin Williams movie called Club Paradise, which was a Harold Ramis film. She went on to star in quite a lot of films, actually, that I didn't realise when I was researching this how many quite big films she'd been in. Fierce Creatures. Have you seen her in Fierce Creatures?
Fierce Creatures I haven't seen for a long time. That's the John Cleese, Kevin Kline movie, isn't it?
She's one of the zoo keepers.
Right.
She was in Sleep in Seattle, Leaving Las Vegas. And then later on, she went on to star in Law and Order, which I've never seen. And I think there's loads of different versions of Law and Order. And she played a character in a lot of those. She was a student, a major in literature at New York University, and she also studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York. So she's got an interesting history as an actress before starring in Bond. Eventually, she got the role in Bond, which she was quite surprised about, based on the fact that she didn't feel like she was actually kind of Bond girl style, to the point where at the audition she actually turned up in like a leather jacket and jeans, as opposed to what you'd probably expect from the sorts of people that turn up for those auditions. After License to Kill, she went on to star, or used her voice in the License to Kill section of the 007 Legends game, which we've talked about on the podcast before. Has a whole level devoted to License to Kill story, and she actually comes in and does the script for that. She most recently she has appeared in Blue Bloods. I don't know if you've seen that.
Nope. Sounds like a cop show.
It's a cop show with what's his face, Magnum.
Tom Selleck.
That's him. Yeah. And then yeah. So, but she hasn't done a lot since those films, really. She's gone a bit quiet. Her personal life is actually a bit more interesting in terms of what she's been doing. So she's been married three times. The last person she was married to was Richard Gere, who they had she was married to for 11 years, and then they spent 3 years in a very contested divorce proceedings. Went to the New York Supreme Court, and eventually it was settled in 2016. So quite an interesting divorce there. So going on to the actual character that she plays, I don't know how much you remember about Pam Bouvier's role in License to Kill. It's an interesting Bond girl, mainly because it's such a strange Bond film in the series. She plays up against Timothy Dalton's very, you know, strict, angry, kind of traditional focus of Bond that he was going for. So when you watch License to Kill, her Bond character is not the same as many of the other Bond characters you'll see previously. So she plays we've seen this quite a lot actually when we talk about Bond girls, and she plays kind of a counterpart to Bond. Basically, she's a CIA agent. There's many scenes in it where you'll probably remember the most famous scene where they're in a bar, and Sanchez's kind of right-hand man, played by Benicio del Toro, is kind of having a go at him. And she says, "Have you got a gun on you?" And Timothy Dalton pulls out his Beretta, and she just kind of shakes her head and pulls out a shotgun from under the table. Pretty classy stuff, where you suddenly go, "Oh yeah, she's in control here. She's gonna give Bond a run for his money." But as it always happens in every single one of these films, where they start off with that whole process of the Bond girl having kind of like being a Bond character, by the end of it, she becomes quite kind of secondary. And there's actually a scene later on where the other Bond girl that's in the film, Sanchez's mistress, towards the end of the film, he has a love interest in both of them, and he's with the mistress at the end. And Pam Bouvier gets very upset and runs off. So to solve the situation, he sets up the mistress with the president of wherever that film is set, so that she's quite happy. She's gone off with the president, and he goes back to Pam Bouvier and says, I pick you. Strange concept for a Bond film, choosing between two women at one point in a film. But obviously at that point, she becomes quite upset and loses her hard edge to kind of, she's fallen in love with him. She's given up on that whole kind of tough angle, and same thing we've seen very, very many times. Dario, that's the name of Benicio del Toro's character. Just spotted it. So that's really her role is in the film. I don't think she's down as one of the big Bond girls in the list. I actually researching through various books and things, she doesn't get a lot of mentions in a lot of encyclopedias and kind of guides to Bond. She's more of a kind of a Bond footnote, Bond girl, really. And she's quite prominent in her role in that film, but she's not really in the big leads when it comes to the history of Bond girls. Some interesting facts about Carrie Lau, though. When she was preparing to play the role of Pam Bouvier, she decided to watch loads of Bond films, as you would, but didn't bother reading any of Ian Fleming's novels because she said, in a way, the books didn't really affect my character. The way Fleming wrote his women was not necessarily the person I was playing. Which is actually quite interesting because Timothy Dalton was obsessed with basing everything on the Fleming books. So,
but I think that there's an argument to say, you know, that the Bond on film and the Bond in the books is very different. And Dalton maybe was trying to bring those two things together, but they're very hard to reconcile, I think.
Yes, I suppose in the 1980s, that was probably the big start, wasn't it, of changing the way the genders roles are played in the films and all that kind of stuff, which is what which is quite clear in both Living Daylights and License to Kill. So you wouldn't have been able to have an Ian Fleming Bond girl in those films. It just wouldn't have worked at that point. But she described becoming a Bond girl as huge shoes to fill, and she never saw herself as a glamour girl. She wore a wig for all of the scenes set in the United States, but she actually had quite short hair. Famously, she had short hair as a model. So there is a scene in License to Kill where she cuts her hair so that you can actually see her real hair on film. Her surname, Bouvier, is a reference to the American First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, as that was her maiden name. That was quite interesting. She's also, I'm not sure how true this is, but apparently Pam Bouvier is the first Bond girl to ever drink one of Bond's signature vodka martini cocktails.
That's
in the Bond
great
series.
Fact.
And in AMC's Bond Girls Are Forever, Carrie Lau said that she shut her eyes and flinched every time she fired a gun and had to be trained to fire with her eyes open because a CIA operative wouldn't flinch when firing a gun. So that's that probably would have looked quite pathetic on screen. Another fact, the screenplay was not ready by the time casting had begun, so Carrie Lau actually auditioned with lines from View to a Kill. So she probably... don't know what she thought about the film when she was reading lines to that.
Good script.
Maybe it wasn't in the horse. No, it wouldn't be in the horse bit, would it? And then, according to the book, The Making of License to Kill by Sally Hibben, Carrie Lau handled herself so well during the fight scenes that members of the stunt team gave her the nickname Pambo.
That's great.
Yeah, it's quite a good name. And also, it's Talisa Soto who played the Sanchez's love interest. And apparently, both her and Carrie Lau refused to pose for Playboy when asked after filming and being in the Bond film.
B is for Boyle, Danny Boyle. So cheating a little bit here because obviously Danny Boyle only has a loose connection to James Bond. But I thought it'd be an interesting person to talk about, obviously, with No Time to Die sort of lingering in the ether. So Daniel Francis Boyle was born the 20th of October in 1956. He's an English film, television and stage director and film producer also. Obviously, best known for his work, his films, feature films, Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, The Beach, 28 Days Later, Sunshine. I mean, his back catalogue is amazing. Slumdog Millionaire, which won the Oscar, 127 Hours, Steve Jobs, and then obviously more recently, Yesterday. He's got quite a distinctive sort of style, I guess. Never really tackles the same genre twice. He's sort of connected to Bond only very loosely in two very different ways. So firstly, he directed the James Bond skit that played at the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics in London. And then secondly, he came very close to directing a James Bond film, Bond 25, as it was at the time, which is now No Time to Die. So the skit, we'll just cover that quickly. So in 2012, Boyle was the artistic director for the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics here in London. And it was called the Isles of Wonder. It was a fantastic opening ceremony. And part of the ceremony was a short film directed by Danny Boyle, and it was called Happy and Glorious. And so I'll just give you a quick summary of what happens there. So you're inside Buckingham Palace. There's a group of Brazilian school children having a guided tour of the of Buckingham Palace. Brazilian because in 4 years' time, it was going to be in Brazil, the Olympics. And then you see a taxi pull up, and they watch this black cab pull up outside Buckingham Palace. A man comes out. You don't really see who it is, runs up the staircase. But when you come to the interior, you see it's Daniel Craig as James Bond in a tuxedo. He runs up the stairs. He goes past some corgis. Now, the corgis feature quite a lot. I don't know if you remember this skit, but the corgis are in it a lot. Yeah. So he meets a footman as he comes up the stairs, who then who greets him. I think he says, "Oh, you know, hello, Mr. Bond." And then he takes him into the Queen's drawing room, where she sat at a writing desk, and she's sort of busy doing some work at a desk. He coughs. She turns around and says, "Good evening, Mr. Bond." And then he escorts her to the helicopter. The helicopter then takes off, flies across London. And then as they get to the Olympic Stadium, they both jump out and the Bond theme plays. It's absolutely brilliant. It's like, it really does play on like what the best things about being British are. It's like one of the few things that, you know.
Yeah, I remember when that came out, and I didn't know that was going to happen.
I don't think anyone knew it was going to happen. I think the Sun sort of leaked it, but no one really followed up on it. So
it was a cool surprise, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So they jump out, and then they fly into the ceremony. So the people that perform the stunt as Bond and the Queen were Mark Sutton and, you'll like this, Gary Connery. They were the stunt people that performed that. One dressed up as the Queen, one dressed up as Bond, and then obviously the Queen then appeared at the stadium, and it looked like she parachuted in. So it's a great little skit. So what actually? That final sketch was not actually what Danny Boyle originally had in mind for this sketch. He had written to Buckingham Palace, really just asking for permission to do the gag. And what they would do is use a double or a close-up, a lookalike of the Queen. Or actually, he looked at getting Helen Mirren to play the Queen. They'd sent out location scouts to look for places that could double for the palace. And actually, what he was looking for when they wrote to the Queen or the palace was that just for permission to do the joke. But actually when they responded, they said the Queen wants to be in it. She wants a talking role and you can have permission to come to the palace to shoot it and blah, blah, blah. So that was it. And actually the most difficult part of making it happen was not getting permission from the Queen or finding time in the Queen's diary to do it. It's actually finding time in Daniel Craig's diary to do it, because at the time he was shooting Skyfall. So they had to work it into the shoot of Skyfall that he was going to do it. I mean, what better promotion for that film?
That's incredible.
Obviously, which came out in winter 2012, for it to play to a global audience at the Olympics. So that's Daniel Craig fully in Skyfall mode, which is amazing when you think about it.
Yeah.
So according to a report online, the Queen didn't want anyone to know that she was doing it. None of her family knew. Charles, Camilla, William, Kate didn't know that the Queen had shot this video for Danny Boyle in the opening. So the first time they saw it was when they watched the opening ceremony.
That's incredible. I'd love to. I mean, it just kind of suggests that the Queen's a Bond fan, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd love to find out what our favourite ones are.
Yeah. What she said is that... that she really wanted to do it for the people that worked at the palace, because she thought it'd be a great day for them to have Daniel Craig as James Bond come in. And so, Daniel Craig in an interview said that, you know, the Queen did a fantastic job. He said, "I'm a big fan of Danny Boyle. He did an amazing job with the opening ceremony. I was proud to be a small part of it. It was quite surreal to be in the palace with the Queen, but Danny was being lovely and so was she." So after Danny Boyle's brush with Bond, obviously he got on very well with Daniel Craig there. Development of the next James Bond film, obviously we had Skyfall, then Spectre, then No Time to Die began development in early 2016. And in 2017, Purvis and Wade started on their script. Sam Mendes ruled himself out about returning for a third Bond film. Christopher Nolan also ruled himself out. And then a bunch of directors were courted at the time, names that kept popping up: Yann Demange, David McKenzie, Denis Villeneuve. These were all names that are in the mix. But by February 2018, it was announced that Danny Boyle was the front runner to take on the on Bond 25. And so his pitch to Brooklyn Wilson was an original idea based on a script from his regular screenwriter, John Hodge. So it was going to be a brand new script, and Purvis and Wade's script was going to be completely scrapped. The draft that John Hodge delivered was greenlit, and then Danny Boyle was confirmed to direct, and the production was due to start shooting in December 2018. So they stayed on the project until August 2018, by which point actually a bunch of people had already been hired. Mark Tilsley, for example, Danny Boyle's regular production designer, he had been hired and started to work on the film. A bunch of people had been, you know, hired. They'd got as far as casting. There were casting sheets that were going around. One casting sheet which got leaked to the press so said that it was looking for a cold and charismatic Russian for a lead role, was looking for a female lead who was witty and skillful survivor, and that also they were looking for a supporting role, someone sounds like a henchman or a heavy, someone of Maori descent with advanced combat skills. And at the time, there was a lot of speculation about why Danny Boyle quit the project. There was talk that there was tension over the casting of the lead villain. He'd apparently wanted to cast this guy, Thomas Cott. But Danny Boyle later said that the dispute was actually over the script that him and Hodge had worked on. And this is what he told Empire magazine in March 2019, so sort of a year after. He said, "What John Hodge and I were doing, I thought was really good. It wasn't finished, but it could have been really good. We were working very, very well, but they didn't want to go down that route with us. We decided to part company, and it would be unfair to say what it was, because I don't know what Carey is going to do." And he's talking about Carey Fukunaga there. "But he got a very nice. I got a very nice message from Carey Fukunaga, and I gave him my best wishes. It's just a great shame." So obviously, he's very disappointed that it didn't work out. Obviously, he had an idea of what he wanted to do for Bond. They had another idea. It's amazing that it got so far down the line and they realised it wasn't working out for them. Mm. Mark so Tilsley...
It's frustrating, isn't it? I think it would have been quite good, but it seems to happen quite frequently on Bond films where they can make these kind of decisions further down the line, just if they think it's not quite right. And it's probably something you don't see as much of in a lot of other films, where it just kind of, you know, they lead them to it. It must be quite difficult for someone like Danny Boyle, but yeah, would have been quite excited to see that.
Yeah, it happens quite a lot, obviously, in the superhero world, doesn't it? You feel like they've got such a clear vision of what they want from these films. And it's obviously the same with Bond as well. Barbara Broccoli and Wilson, Michael G. Wilson, have a clear idea. And so when it starts to deviate, they know the formula, they know what works. It becomes very risky for them.
Well, it's testament to the films, isn't it, really, that if people are keeping an eye on it all the time, and you've got these other films that maybe they don't mind which direction it goes in, as long as it gets made by the date that it's meant to be done. But yeah, it's true. Yeah, the Marvel films are quite similar.
Do we have any idea what direction that was that Danny Boyle was taking?
Yeah, I've got some. There is a little bit of information out there. Like I said, Mark Tilsley was brought on as the production designer, Danny Boyle's regular production designer. And he's done a few interviews since then, because obviously he went on to work on what is now No Time to Die. He, in an interview with Total Films, said that what Boyle was planning for Bond was extraordinary. But he also said that Boyle's ideas weren't completely cohesive at the time. And I think maybe they just weren't coming together at the speed that they that the producers needed. Tilsley said, unfortunately, Danny's crazy madcap ideas didn't quite tie up with what Barbara and Michael had planned. It was definitely a good thing to do. Maybe another time, though. I'm revving Barbara up to have another go with Danny. He had some extraordinary ideas. They just needed a little pulling together. And later on, he, Mark Tilsley, this is a really great interview, actually. It's on YouTube. It's with the Media and Film Masterclass with the Media and Film Studies, LPSB. He did an interview where he revealed that he was already in the process of building a 350-foot rocket on the 007 stage at Pinewood, and in the process of building a Russian gulag in the mountains in Canada when it all started to fall apart. So he was already building these sets, and it just all came to a standstill. Although Tilsley says that he'd wants Boyle to have another go at doing Bond, I think Boyle has ruled himself out. He's said that I think he's been put off the idea of making big juggernaut franchise films like this. He said to in an interview with the Metro, he said, I learned my lesson that I'm not cut out for franchises. Otherwise, you're just digging in the same hole. I am better not quite in the mainstream franchise movie is the honest answer. I learned quite a lot about myself with Bond. I work in partnerships with writers and I'm not prepared to break it up. So I think it's just a case of that he wasn't prepared to toe the line for what he wanted. There is a rumor that he wanted to kill off Bond in his version.
Yeah.
But when I think about Danny Boyle, I think he would have been a very left field choice for Bond, because although he has made, 28 Days Later, you could say is a thriller. What was that heist film? Trance. Sort of, but he's never really made that sort of action spectacular that you want from Bond.
Yeah, he's probably around that time where, and you've seen it quite a lot with Wilson and Broccoli, where they're probably looking at these directors, and they do it with actors and stuff as well, where they go, this we want this left field thing, we want this more arty version of what we do, we want to see how it would work. But when it actually comes down to the line, you can't get that far away from the Bond formula, can you? You can't change the format of it, because it just won't work. And it sounds like it probably, sometimes it takes him a bit of time to realise that, but you know straight away from hiring Danny Boyle, that's a risk. And it could not work. But it sounds like they let it go too far down the line before realising that.
But it would have been very interesting for it to go through, because I think... while they might not be a match made in heaven,
yeah,
I think I'd certainly be interested in seeing what the outcome was.
Well, it could be amazing, couldn't it? It could change the future of Bond if you take one of these more left field directors and get them to do it. But I mean, I suppose it gets harder and harder the more Bond films you make, because you can't risk it. Really, it's
you want people want what know what they want, but they want the same but different. It's just an impossible situation, isn't it? I guess that it's quite interesting that they then went with Cary Fukunaga, who had a track record of, falling out on projects with producers himself. Like, he worked on the It film for a long time and then, walked off that project because he fell out with the producers on that. I think even at the time, he felt like a bit of a risky proposition, but fair play to him. He's delivered a film. Now we're just waiting to see it. Whether Danny Boyle will feature again in the future of Bond, we shall have to wait and find out.
If that happened to you, maybe if you were like a Michael Billington character and you were nearly there all the time but never quite made it, it's a bit different than putting loads of effort in and then coming off of it, and then you probably wouldn't want to risk that again, would you? Especially if I imagine it probably wasn't the best relationship at the time when that happened. So it doesn't sound too likely, but definitely an interesting one to see.
Never,
if that did
never
happen.
Say never again.
Yeah, maybe he'll direct a Never Say Never Again remake.
So up next we have Brandt, Helga Brandt, also known as Number 11. She's the personal assistant to Japanese industrialist Mr. Osato, and also a member of Spectre. She's portrayed by the German actress Karin Dorr, and she appears in the 1967 film You Only Live Twice. So there's not much known about the character Helga Brandt. She's quite mysterious. She's got red hair. She's known as number 11 with Inspector. And she, at some point within the gap between Thunderball and You Only Live Twice, has inherited the title number 11 from her predecessor, who was played by Murray Cash in Thunderball. So it's a promotion, I would imagine, that's got her that. So she's number 11. And so she works as a secretary. That's where we see her first. But she's sort of asked to do a lot of those tasks, undercover tasks, such as a waitress, pilot, torturer and assassin. So sort of used as she's needed, really.
Jack of all trades for assassins.
Yeah. Dial an assassin. Mm. Yeah. So spends the whole that time sort of knowing that she's dispensable, treading on eggshells. So making sure she does the job well. Otherwise, she'll face the wrath of Stavro Blofeld. So she's seen on the operations room off Spectre's volcanic launch site in the film, and she helps with the capture of a Soviet spacecraft. Blofeld then summons Asato and Number 11 for a report and tells them off because they've failed to recognise and kill Bond. So Asato tries to shift the blame over to Brandt, who then sort of fires back. Oh, you should have killed him. You had the chance. So Blofeld reminds them that Spectre don't tolerate failure and bids them farewell and gives Asato one last chance. Unfortunately, not the same can be said for Helga Brandt, because she features in quite a grisly death. She's walks across a suspension bridge, a bridge suspended above a pool of piranhas, and Blofeld
classic
drops her into the piranha pool, where she is shredded to pieces.
Yeah,
and that's her journey within the character's journey anyway within You Only Live Twice.
Probably one of the most memorable deaths in the whole of the series. That piranha tank.
So the character itself, she was created specifically for the adaptation of the novel by Roald Dahl. So Roald Dahl created this character. So there's no real similar character that existed before that. There's many European models at the time were tested to play the character, but finally came down to Karin Dorr being cast. So in terms of Karin Dorr, she performed that stunt herself, the final death stunt. She did the drop without the use of a double. She didn't obviously get ripped to shreds.
So. Stunt piranhas.
weird fact that she was actually dubbed by another actress for the German version of You Only Live Twice. So Karin Dorr is an actual brunette, and the producers actually wanted a blonde German girl to play the character, but they ended up with Karin Dorr. So as a compromise, that's why they dyed the character's hair red. During the actual filming, Karin Dorr was nearly hit by a falling spotlight in a brush with death. So Karin Dorr, born, it's pronunciation again, here we go, born Katarosa Dörr.
Okay,
that'll do.
Okay. 22nd of February 1938, was a German actress, and she was born in Wiesbaden in Germany. So she also starred in Alfred Hitchcock's movie Topaz.
Really? Seen that. Yeah.
Yes. And surprisingly, I found this hard to believe, she's the only German Bond girl.
Is that right? Yes. Wow.
That does seem hard to believe.
I went through the whole list. I was like, no, that's got enough. Yeah, she's the only German one.
There's got to be one in an Imagine Secret Service.
There's not. I've scoured the list. You can scour it too if you want.
No, I'm not going to scour it. That was your job.
So she then had a long, illustrious theatre career within Germany. And sadly, in July 2016, she was on holiday and she was knocked to the ground after being rammed by a woman with a pushchair. She then fell onto the concrete and she got a 4-centimetre head wound, and which had to be stitched in hospital. So she lost her memory for that duration. So that hour is lost, so she doesn't remember what happened. And the doctors didn't detect anything amiss at the time. Only a few weeks later, during rehearsals for a play, did they realise that the injuries were more serious than first thought. Even months after the accident, the effects were still present. She wasn't feeling up to herself. She had problem walking. But she remained positive and she kept on working. So she was still performed on stage every evening as well. So she still carried on. But then in January 2017, so that's a year and a half. No, that's 6 months. So 6 months after, she relapsed. And her condition rapidly worsened 2 months after that. She was confined to a care home where she died aged 79 on the 6th of November 2017.
Oh, what a shame.
So quite a sad end to her life there. But she celebrated her time with 007. She said, "It's unbelievable. I get a lot of people asking for autographs, a lot from America and Japan, even from Russia. It was very enjoyable. I love the picture and the people I worked with."
So that's great.
Yeah,
great character. She's a really interesting one. That, as you say, there wasn't really anyone like her before. They did have femme fatales like Volpe and Thunderball, mm-hmm. but nobody that's quite like. She always seemed a bit out of all of the kind of femme fatales that worked under Blofeld in the earlier films. She always seemed a little bit more nervous or scared all the time of Blofeld, which you don't often see in it with the Blofeld baddies. I don't know if that was intentional, but definitely came across that way.
Yeah, I think it definitely does come across. I really like the first scene where she meets Bond, because they've got the interaction about the is it Bollinger? But yeah, so Helga Brandt, good character.
B is for Bricus, Leslie Bricus. So you'll know Leslie Bricus for Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. Only did those two Bond films. I didn't actually know a great deal about Leslie Bricus until I researched him, and he is a phenomenal man who his history in the industry is just ridiculous. Like, he's one of those old school kind of celebrity creators that just knew everybody and was involved in everything, and some of the stories that he's involved with are just absolutely ridiculous. I started like watching documentaries about him, and he's got a book I'll talk about in a bit, but there is so much. He's like the Roger Moore of composing. He's just got a story about everything, and if you go on YouTube and look for documentaries, interviews and stuff with him, he's just reeling off these famous people's stories just like Roger Moore does. Absolutely phenomenal. He's like done so much. So I'll just go through the highlights. He was born in January 1931. He's an English composer. He's a lyricist and a playwright, and he does all of those things quite a lot. Normally you'd get somebody who just does one or two of those things, but he does all of them. He's done so many like songs and musicals over the years. Some of the main ones he's worked on are Dr. Dolittle, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Scrooge, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Hook he did as well, and he's got loads of like songs that he's worked on. He did the song for Superman in 1978 called Can You Read My Mind, the love theme. Some of his most famous songs, Candyman and Pure Imagination, obviously from Willy Wonka and Chocolate Factory. Pure Imagination is actually the name of his biography. autobiography. And then interestingly, he did a song for Home Alone, Christmas at Hogwarts for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And yeah, he's just done loads. He's won an two Academy Awards for Talk to the Animals for Best Original Song from Dr. Dolittle in 1968, and Best Adaptation of an Original Song Score for Victor Victoria. I'd never seen that. He has a Grammy Award. He's got loads of nominations for various different things. Ridiculous man. He's done so much, and he's really nice as well. If you ever watch an interview with him, he's just a nice old guy who's just telling these really nice little stories. His personal life, he was born in Pinner in Middlesex. Interesting fact, Elton John was also born there and also went to school there, and at the same time as Leslie went there. So must be something about that school that generates songwriters. Later on, he moved to Hollywood. And started working on all these big musicals and things like that. He was educated at University College School in London, and then at Gonville and Chaos College, Cambridge. And while he was at Cambridge, he was secretary of Footlights between 1952 and 1953, and the Footlights president during the following year. So, yeah, that's straight away. He's pretty important to this kind of performing arts, and this is where he started to know everyone. And if you ever look at a list of people that have been to Footlights, it's absolutely ridiculous, like the people that went there and started performing there. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s and 70s, Brickus enjoyed or he worked with Anthony Newley, who, like Brickus, is an incredibly talented man. He worked on loads of musicals with him, and Anthony Newley is actually, he's more of a singer and a songwriter. And they had this kind of partnership where they worked together on all these different projects, and it was one of the big partnerships that you'd get from back in the golden years of Hollywood and musicals. They wrote the musical Stop the World, I Want to Get Off in 1961, Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd, and Willy Wonka and Chocolate Factory. He's done other stuff as well. He's worked with Sammy Davis Jr. On What Kind of Fool Am I? From Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and Candyman. Sammy Davis Jr. had big hits for those songs that were written and created by Leslie. He has worked with Nina Simone on Feeling Good, which did very well. Matt Monro and Frank Sinatra, My Kind of Girl. Shirley Bassey, obviously, which I'll come to in a second. Harry Secombe, If I Ruled the World. And Nancy Sinatra, of course, on You Only Live Twice. He also worked with George Tipton, who to write the opening theme of the US television series It's a Living. I haven't seen that sitcom. Apparently it's quite popular. So that's a bit of history about Leslie and kind of where he comes from. And I mean, there's a lot more than that, that you could go on for ages about the stories that he's involved with. But eventually he worked on Goldfinger and got involved in the Bond films. And I've actually mentioned this, I think, when we talk on another podcast, but John Barry played in the original notes of Goldfinger to Leslie and Anthony Newley. And at the time, they just both started singing the melody to Moon River, Wider Than a Mile, because it's just start very similar. And apparently Barry was not amused. But he says one source of inspiration for the song was Mac the Knife, which director Guy Hamilton showed John Barry, thinking it was gritty and rough, a gritty and rough song that could be a model for what the film requires. And Brickus and Newley were not shown any film footage or script excerpts for the Goldfinger song. They were actually only told about the Jill Masterson scene with the gold. So they based the whole of this Goldfinger song just off that, which you can kind of get quite from this. It's really all the song is about, isn't it? They just know there's a baddie who's done this thing to... who's obsessed with gold, and there's this woman involved. So really simple premise that they've pulled together. Yeah, once him and Newley hit upon utilising the Midas touch line, that was like the key to that song, that's apparently the whole song just came together. They realised what it was all about as soon as they just picked out that line. And then, of course, they went on to do You Only Live Twice. He went off to work with Don Black. And... interestingly, he was pulled in to You Only Live Twice, and they did a early version of the song, which was never actually used, and it was never actually credited either until they created the new version, which of course had Nancy Sinatra that did it. There's many stories about how they pulled You Only Live Twice together and who they wanted to do it. They actually wanted Frank Sinatra to do it because he was friends with Cubby Broccoli at the time, but then they ended up getting Frank Sinatra's daughter to do it, which works very well. Other things he's known for are he wrote the lyrics to My Old Man's a Dustman, which was sang by Lonnie Donegan. I didn't know a lot about him, but he's not credited for it. But he did it under the pseudonym of Beverly Thorne. Don't know why he chose that. Really interesting story for you, Butler. He just written a song for Home Alone with John Williams, and John Williams called him to just say how pleased he was with the final lyrics. And then he during the call, he said, "Oh, so hold on, I've got to go and speak to someone." And he came back and he said, "Oh, that was the young prince." And apparently that's what John Williams called Steven Spielberg. And he was telling him how much he liked your lyrics. He wants to know if you want to work on Hook. That's how he got involved in the film Hook. And he says that's how his business has started. It's just like all these happenstance things happened where he just was speaking to somebody, he did something else. But it was mainly at the time when he was working on Dr. Doolittle. He said that he just kind of met people and he just got involved in lots of different things. Everyone just knew he was just this musical writer, so he just got all these jobs off the back of it, and that's how he met John Williams and all these sorts of people. And there was a producer called Arthur Jacobs who worked on Dr. Doolittle. He was a famous publicist and also Marilyn Monroe's press agent. And he came along to him, and he actually found out that Leslie had written a score for Noah's Ark, which was just some musical that I'd never heard of. But because it was about animals, he said, we'll get you involved in this new thing we're doing called Dr. Doolittle, because he'd written all these songs about animals. So he just got into all these things because of these weird little chance encounters, which I think is something, it's a quite an old style thing and probably happened quite a lot in the golden years of Hollywood, where there probably weren't a lot of people that, it's not like nowadays where if you want to find a producer or a director or a musician, it's quite easy. But back in those days, you didn't just know loads of them. You'd probably just go, "Well, I know somebody's working on this film. Let's speak to them.
It's got animals in it.
It's got animals in it. We'll get them involved." So yeah, that was quite an interesting kind of into how he was getting all of this work. And so he's done all sorts of stuff, a ridiculous amount of things. He wrote a book called Pure Imagination, a Sorter Biography. It's apparently is a massive book and just talks about all his life in the stage and all this kind of stuff. And it got there was a version of, or it wasn't a version of the book, but there was a stage show that was made about his life, and it was 50 of his songs that he'd written and performed by these stage singers and dancers, which was in 2015. Which I watched some clips of it and looked really good. So he's just an amazing man. He's just had an enormous range of things that he's been involved with. But yeah, if you look at the two songs that he's done for Bond, I'm surprised he didn't do more actually after that, because you know they were quite good. I always find it quite difficult with these kind of writers, composers, lyricists, because even though they're, you know, it says that they wrote these songs, they tend to write them together, and it's really difficult to work out who does what.
Yeah.
And he was saying that when he started working on things, there was a documentary I watched where somebody was saying, "So what was your job on that? And what was the job of Anthony Newley?" And he was like, "Well, we didn't even know. We just sat down and one of us would go, well, I've got this idea. And the other one would do the other bits." So yeah, it's a bit, I always find it quite difficult to work out how much these people have worked on things and what bit is theirs. But he's definitely, he's massively respected in the industry and has done so much stuff over the years that, yeah, as I say, I'm surprised he didn't end up doing more after those two.
Yeah, if he's got a track record like that, you would imagine that he is part of the magic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and he talks a lot, which I find really interesting, about context. And he was saying that there's a big difference between being a musical writer or a lyricist for a film, because you have context. Whereas if you're a songwriter who's just writing songs for an album, There's no context. You're writing words about something that doesn't mean anything outside of that song. But if people come to him and they say, right, Leslie, there's a scene with a monkey that's trying to steal a, I don't know, banana off of the Dr. Dolittle. And he just goes, I know exactly what. So all I need to do in this scene is convey that there's a monkey trying to do that. So that context makes it really, really simple. So that's like with Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. He had the context.
Yeah.
And the context is the film, isn't it? And you've just got to make the song fit that context, and it works. And if you think about that with some of the other Bond songs, there isn't really a context of it. Like, I don't know, what View to a Kill soundtrack. I don't think that song's got a lot of context to the actual film. It just uses a line from it, really. Mm-hmm. But that's where this kind of old magic style of writing comes in. And I mean, with Goldfinger, Goldfinger especially, I mean, that song is so synonymous with that film, isn't it? That it just fits perfectly. And You Only Live Twice as well. That it's just a brilliant song. And as I mentioned before, they did another version of You Only Live Twice before they came to the final version. And they got rid of it. It's a very good song,
yeah,
but they just thought it. He'd put all the work into it. They'd worked together to create it, and they just said after a bit, we're not using it. It's just not right. We're going to go back and we're going to try something else, which is great, isn't it? Really.
Mm. Some of the audio cues carry over, I think, from listening to it. That sort of oriental sound that it sort of has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have reused what they had, but they just. Yeah, it just wasn't right. And I can't imagine, I'm not sure, but I feel with the new many of the new ones, especially like the Daniel Craig era guitar ones, I don't imagine that's as big an issue. It's more like having a great song or a good song that they want. It doesn't have to be synonymous with the film.
Yeah.
But that's just my view.
Leslie Bricus, then.
So there we have it. Leslie Bricus, great man.
B is for Brioni. Now, Brioni is an Italian menswear house. It's actually now owned by a French company called Kering, but it was founded in Rome in 1945. And its connection to the Bond franchise is that Brioni supplied the suits for all of Pierce Brosnan's films and also for Daniel Craig's first film, Casino Royale. It's a bespoke clotheswear brand, and it's known for its suits, its ready-to-wear collections, and actually it's quite famous in the world of fashion for inventing a lot of different concepts, including the men's runway show. They were the first company to do a runway show for men's fashion, which I thought was quite interesting. Now, a Brioni suit, if you wanted to buy one, will cost you about £3,000.
No, I'm all right.
So yeah, they're not messing around. But yeah, so the Brioni suits were introduced to Bond by the costume designer on GoldenEye, Lindy Hemming. In the book James Bond, The Suited Hero, she explained that she wanted to find a suit that was like similar to Savile Row, so someone that was capable of tailoring in a Savile Row manner. But also she needed to find a brand that could produce a lot of suits very quickly because of the shooting schedule for GoldenEye. It had to be, you know, for Bond, it had to be a luxury brand, and it had to be something that was synonymous with being, you know, reassuringly expensive. So Brioni was the designer that she landed on. Talking about the attitude and ethics of the house of Brioni, Lindy Hemming said, "They were absolutely open to any sort of idea. They have a lifetime of making clothes for presidents and politicians, and they don't have that thing where they can't change what is going on. So if it needs 13 inside pockets or a jacket with no vents or another one that he needs to open completely down the back, they can do it." And so that was, you know, this brand dressed Brosnan, and it's quite a distinctive style for Bond for that entire period. I think you remember it's quite a loose fitting, but, you know, with big shoulders, but quite a macho looking brand as well. So that continued through Brosnan's era into Casino Royale. And actually Daniel Craig, when they did the press conference, Daniel Craig wore a Brioni suit at the press conference. And the tuxedo that he wears in Casino Royale is Brioni as well. There's a story about, I don't know if you know this, about the audition. You know when they do screen tests to play Bond, so they basically do the same scene every time. It's a scene from Russia with Love, and there are photos of Daniel Craig doing his screen test. He's got longer hair than he's used to, but he's like, you know, buff. And they say that the suit that he's wearing in that scene is Brioni, and he strips down to his trousers. So he's wearing Brioni there as well, because obviously that was just the brand that was around with Bond at the time. And there's that famous photo of him with the gun, with the silencer that they used to announce him as Bond. Apparently that's a Brioni suit, although that's not ever been confirmed. Just before Casino Royale came out, Brioni, the brand, launched a £3,000 Bond-themed tuxedo, which has 007 stitched into the lining of the jacket, and it's only sold, you know, in a handful of places. So talking about the company's relationship with Bond, Antonella De Simone, she's the Italian co-chief executive, she said that our tailors would go to London for all the fittings. Bond has always been an icon of style and sartorial elegance, and we dressed other characters too, including Miss Moneypenny. So they dressed Miss Moneypenny. In Casino Royale, everyone at the casino table was dressed by Brioni, and these were very strange guys. A big black man, a fat man, the models, all the people at the table were wearing Brioni. Also thinking back to the Brosnan era, you know, Die Another Day, when he's in Cuba and he's got that blue shirt on. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's very distinctive. Mm-hmm. That's Brioni as well. So interestingly, as we've discussed with the situation with Aston Martin, there's no money is exchanged for the relationship for Brioni and James Bond, according to Lindy Hemming and the Brioni people as well. So Brioni don't pay for the privilege of dressing Bond. And obviously that comes at a cost to them, but then they get the luxury of being the Bond brand right of the time. And actually when Pierce Brosnan used to put his Brioni suit on while he was on set, he used to say, "I'm putting on Bond." That's how like he saw the Brioni brand. So talking about not paying for the privilege of being in the Bond film, De Simone said, "This is not our policy. We were chosen for our art, never for money. We want to be discreet and elegant, outside the glamour and the noise." So that was it. So Brioni's relationship with Bond ended after Casino Royale. It's not really clear why. I think Lindy Hemming didn't come back to do Quantum of Solace, and they brought in a new costume designer. And at that time, because obviously there's a costume designer on the film, and then there's the brand that supplies the suit as well. And it was at that point that then Tom Ford came in to dress Bond and has done ever since. It's not really clear why they changed brand, but yeah, I guess it was probably a decision of the costume designer that, you know, Bond had come back and he needed a new style to move forward with. And
yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's that whole it seems to me like with Aston Martin and Brioni, maybe even like Omega Seamaster and things like that, that they get more out of it than the Bond like franchise does. Like the BMW deal, there was a clear marketing angle where they were doing adverts for the mainstream, weren't they? They were getting free advertising, but I've never seen an advert for Brioni. But maybe just having it with Bond actually means that the people who buy Brioni suits are more likely to buy it. And
it's the advert itself, isn't it? The film is the advert. And actually, when you read into it, Brioni very rarely, you know, in their shops, they wouldn't have like standees of Pierce Brosnan in the suit.
So they wouldn't capitalise on that.
They didn't really capitalise on it. No, they just took the association and you know, enjoyed the relationship.
Well, that's probably what people who can afford those kind of suits, that's probably what they like. The kind of,
yeah, it's understated,
modest,
isn't it?
Subtle, yeah. Understated. Yeah, mm-hmm. You don't want to see your suit on an advert all the time.
No, you think of like, you know, the aristocracy. You don't see them wearing their like designer brands with like logos and stuff, do they? They just want something, you know, they want the barber jacket that does its job as it's supposed to. It's quite interesting. Yeah, but that's Brioni. So Not much more to add to that. Where are we going next?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the screen test, because B is for Brolin, James Brolin, born Craig Kenneth Brudelin. So it's still a B, so we're okay with his real name as well. he's born July 18th, 1940. He's an American actor, producer, director. He's the father of Josh Brolin, and he's the husband of Barbra Streisand, who is his third wife. He's also got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which he got in 1998. So, his story, how he's linked to Bond. So, in 1982, he was cast to play James Bond in Octopussy, the 13th Bond film. Actually cast. So, he was actually cast to be James Bond in Octopussy. But he fell victim to that period of time where Roger Moore was doing the will he, won't he. You know, they were trying to coax him back, as we covered in previous episodes of the podcast. He fell victim to this in quite a big way, because he'd got the gig. He'd bought a place in London, a flat, an apartment.
Yeah, I read
to live
this.
In.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So he'd gone back to America to up and leave and pack all this stuff, and that's when he got the call where they said Roger Moore's agreed to do it. So, and obviously that was because the Sean Connery was coming back to make Never Say Never Again, and they thought, we need to go in that direction, have familiarity rather than a new Bond. So Roger Moore had said, this is a quote from Brolin, Roger Moore had said, I'm not doing any more Bond. So Cubby Broccoli starts interviewing people and flies me over, takes me to all the great spots, then finally decides. We talked about having an intercontinental accent. I'm not British, and a lot of people are going to object. Anyway, I got my flat, I started working out with the stuntmen, and then I went back to collect all my stuff, because I'm going to be gone a year. I'm home about a week, and I get a message that Roger Moore has decided to do Octopussy. So it really was all done. You know, he'd already started on working on it, and the accent, so the screen tests, they're on the internet, they're on YouTube, and you can watch them. So the accent, it's not as strong American as his own accent, but it's certainly not British either. It's got that transatlantic feel to it. So yeah, this was the closest that we've ever come to having an American playing the role of James Bond, and there's a lot, I'm sure we'll discuss this in the future in the podcast, there's a lot of actors who have turned it down because they don't see it right, be an American playing Bond, which the more I think about it, the more I think that's quite silly, really. I mean, it doesn't matter, does it?
I think it's the same principle as the Aston Martin and stuff like that. It's like you've made a rule, you've drawn a line in the sand, and you're saying this, we're sticking to this rule. And it kind of defines it from there on. Mm. But at that point with Brolin, they probably didn't have that rule. They had Sean Connery, they had Roger Moore. At that point, they probably were open to all these different ideas of where people came from. It was only later on, they probably got to after Dalton and said, oh, we've got a rule here, haven't we? We've now got like four people now that are going to be English. Well, apart from one.
Well, Scottish, Australian,
yeah. Well,
Welsh.
Yeah, British. Welsh. Sorry, you've got one Australian that fits in there.
Yeah, you've only got two English.
Yeah, British.
But the fact that there's only two English actors that have played it means that rule that they've sort of created for themselves.
Yeah,
doesn't even.
It's true, but yeah, that's for us. But for if you're an American.
Of course.
They don't see a massive distinction between Britons and English people and all that kind of stuff. So it's abroad, there's probably a kind of marketing level of it where you want it to be British, otherwise it changes the
thing about Bond is, though, and I think if they're going to get an American to play him, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. But they have to have the British accent. I think they have to be
clearly defined
as British, because the thing about Bond is, he is, he's a very British character. He's a rogue. He's, he, and he does all these dastardly deeds, and the kicker is that he's doing it in the name of Queen and country. That's the whole point.
He's not a spy for hire, is he? He's doing it for a reason.
He's doing it for the good of his own country, and it's a very British thing. Mm. And so, like, you can give it to anyone you want. You know, they auditioned Christophe Lambert. You know, he was French. But you've got to make him British, and you know, I'm sure James Brolin would have been great, and actually he really looks the part when you look at him.
He really does. Yeah. Mm. He reminds me of Christian Bale in the screen test.
He does look like him. Yeah.
So in 1985, Brolin actually parodied his the whole Bond saga in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. He stars in, it's a little tiny bit, it's a film within a film, and he merges the characters of Pee-wee and Bond to become Herman, P.W. Herman, and he checks in at a hotel, and it's just a short, silly scene. Again, it's available online to watch, but that's quite a nice nod to his story regarding Bond. So after this, he goes on to continue his acting career. A huge hit as Peter McDermott, who is a general manager of a hotel in a TV series called Hotel. I don't know if any of you have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so more recently, you're looking at films like Traffic, Steven Soderbergh's Traffic,
mm-hmm.
Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can, Last Chance Harvey with Emma Thompson and Dustin Hoffman in 2008. He played the Republican opponent of Jed Bartlett in The West Wing. He also portrayed Ronald Reagan in a TV film called The Reagans. He's been in Monk. He's also been in Law and Order. Don't know which version, but he plays an astronaut, so maybe there's a space version. He's in Psych, Castle. So he's doing his bits and pieces in TV in America, but he... From 2015 to 2019, he played the role of John in CBS comedy Life in Pieces. Have you seen that one?
No.
It's a pretty long stint, so that finished in 2019. So, yeah, he's had a...
Busy man.
A solid career, but didn't get that... Well, he did get it, but didn't actually get to...
Oh, there's so many. We'll have to do a... collect all of the people that have almost, but never actually...
Yeah. Yeah.
Made it to the shooting day. It's quite sad, really, isn't it?
That's eye-wateringly close, that is, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah, that beats Billington, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But he is the father of Thanos, so...
Yeah, Josh Brolin, obviously, in No Country for Old Men, starred opposite Silver.
Yeah.
Skyfall, what's his name? What's the actor's name? Javier Bardem.
A little
link back to Bond there.
Also, the second time we've mentioned Thanos in the podcast seems to be becoming a theme.
So yeah, that's James Brolin.
Great,
interesting.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Next episode will be another special. We've reached the point where we will be talking about the Broccolis. Obviously, as we always say, we try to get all the information as correct as possible. But if we've missed anything, or if you have anything you want to add or tell us about any of the people we've talked about this week, then please email us on bondatozpodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, but thank you for listening. Please leave us a good review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And till next time.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.